You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Alistair MacLeod. He has a background as a stockbroker, banker, economist. He is a senior fellow at the Gold Money Foundation and head of research at Gold Money, and his weekly articles written for Gold Money are posted on his blog at goldmoney.com. Thanks for joining me again, Alistair. It's really good to have you with me, and Happy New Year to you.
It's my pleasure, Jay, and Happy New Year to you as well.
Thank you so much. Well, I really want to talk to you today about an article that you just wrote titled Investment Prospects for 2018, and you start the article out by noting that very high-paid economists keep getting it wrong year after year, yet they keep getting paid lots and lots of money. Sounds like the definition of insanity. Keep doing the same thing and expect different results. You're saying essentially forget about what the mainstream economists are saying and pay more attention to capital flows. If you want to know where markets are heading next year, look at the banking sector and what the bankers are up to. I think that's very good advice. So maybe you could start talking about that a little bit. I mean, I think you're on the same page as Michael Oliver, who's on this show frequently. Michael is convinced that 2018 is going to be a very significant year for the credit markets, for the bond markets, the Bund and the Japanese bond and the U.S. Treasuries. But he thinks the European bonds, the Bund is perhaps most vulnerable. So, but in any event, talk to us a little bit about the credit cycle. You've talked to us about that before as well, and it's always made a lot of sense. So perhaps tell us where you think we're at as we enter 2018 in the credit cycle and what that might mean for the markets.
Yes, sure. I think you have to look at it almost from a bank's point of view. When a bank is frightened of lending to industry because they've just been through a credit crisis or whatever, then what they tend to do is to put their spare capacity into government bonds. In the case mm-hmm. of America, we're talking about U.S. Treasuries. They are effectively forced buyers at the top of the market mm-hmm. because at that point, the Treasury's yield will be at the low point in the whole credit cycle. Yet the banks buy at that time because they don't want to have their capital at risk. And as well as that, I mean, particularly if you look at the European banks, Basel 2 and 3 basically tells the banks you do not need to have any risk weighting for sovereign debt. So you can go and buy Italian debt or whatever as if the government was never, ever, ever going to default. It does not impact on your capital adequacy margins and all that sort of stuff. You've got to take nothing off for risk. So, you know, there is actually a lot of incentive for a frightened banker to go and buy these things. Mm-hmm. But then, as the credit cycle progresses, and guess what? People in the normal real world continue to do things, you know, like make things, mm-hmm. buy things, yeah. and so on and so forth. You know, life goes on. Bankers suddenly wake up to the fact that, well, perhaps it should be lending a bit of money to ordinary businesses as opposed to people in the financial sector, which is where they tend to concentrate to begin with. The effect of that, of course, is that they then start competing with each other to go and lend. But they have got to sell down their portfolio of government bonds in order to do it. And, of course, at that point, what's happened? The yields have risen, which, put another way, means that the prices have fallen. Mm-hmm. So they realize a loss on their government securities in order to go and lend to real people, if you like, in Main Street. And that cycle happens every credit cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really, you know, it's not that It's not that the banks take investment decisions. They don't. What they do is they try and avoid risk as much as possible, which is a very, very different thing. So, you know, when they have to sell because they need to raise cash, which, of course, is always the worst reason to sell, you know, if you put yourself in that position. So banks always get, they're always on the wrong end of this cycle. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason that's relevant is if you look at the five-year U.S. Treasury bond, which I show a chart of in the article you referred to,
yes.
You'll see that the yield bottomed out at, I can't remember what the figure was, I think it was around about 0.6% way back in 2012, beginning of 2013. It then sort of went up a bit and moved sideways, but then it suddenly accelerated mm-hmm. in the middle of 2016. Now, what that tells me is that the banks, if you like, were beginning to lend to ordinary people, if you like, ordinary businesses, real businesses, at that time. And now, of course, they're actually sitting on losses on any bond like that. If you move in, I mean, the reason I select the five-year, by the way, is it's mm-hmm. the longest maturity that a bank is likely to carry willingly on its balance sheet. Mm-hmm. Shorter maturities are obviously more affected by changes in interest rates by the Fed. If the Fed raises the Fed funds rate, then that's obviously going to impact at the short end of the yield curve. So what we're looking at is all these U.S. treasuries are now showing losses for the banks. So what do? Do they sit on it or do they think, hold on, the economy is actually going quite well now. We're not as worried as we were. If we do not lend to Main Street, our competitors are going to lend to Main Street. So what we've got to do is we've got to get in there and get market share. And that roughly is where the U.S. banking system is today.
Yeah. So what really starts the cycle then is this competitive issue, I guess. So the economy is getting better. Things seem to be, you know, the worst is over. Banks feel more safe. So they don't feel as urgent a need to hold treasuries, but they're looking around and they're seeing other banks are starting to make bigger spreads by lending money into the real economy. Yeah. So then we have money getting into the real economy, which then what happens? We start seeing better GDP, better growth. Times seem to be getting better. I mean, we're seeing a bit of that right now in the U.S., it seems, right? Mm.
Yeah, not only in the U.S., but all around the world. I mean, it's interesting, this new year comes from the IMF paper saying, you know, everything is looking wonderful for 2018. Now, that's fine up to a point, but actually what you have is you have all this bank credit being expanded into the real economy, whether it's in America or Europe or Britain or Japan or wherever. But you've only got a limited capacity for the goods and services that all this money is going to be buying. So what happens? The prices start rising. And then what happens is that not only, you know, as soon as the prices start rising, inflation, you know, price inflation taking off, you begin to reassess what should the yield be on my U.S. treasuries or the corporate bonds or whatever. So you can see that actually this thing, you know, quite quickly can move into that final stage of the credit cycle before you get the credit crisis. And that is the economy is going like beginning to go like a train. It looks jolly good, but the, you know, there's shortages of this commodity, that commodity. You've got, you know, no inventory left. You've got people having to chase prices in order to get things in to manufacture. And suddenly you've got an inflation problem. And that, to me, very much looks like the outlook for the dollar in 2018. It's also the outlook for everywhere else. And you made an earlier reference, I think when we were, before we started this, mm-hmm. but the bond markets in Europe. I mean, they are so badly wrong-footed. They are in a worse position than the U.S. Treasury market. If you look at the 2-year German Schacht bond, it yields minus 0.6%.
Wow.
I mean, this is absolutely crazy. It should be yielding, I don't know, Germany's economy has been going like a train now for the last 2 or 3 years. You know, the bond yield there should be, I would have thought, positive, about 1 or 2%. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Bundesbank, the old boys at the Bundesbank, who are basically sound money men, they've had all this taken out of their hands, all being done across the road in Frankfurt by the ECB, who are all on tax-free salaries, by the way, unlike the guys at the Bundesbank.
Yeah.
And they see this. They must be tearing their hair out, thinking this is a disaster. So in a sense, it's hardly surprising when you look at the demand for gold in Europe. The country which really is buying physical gold is Germany. The Germans are buying it. They see this and they think, oh dear, this is not good. So, and you can say the same thing about Japan. I mean, you've got negative rates in Japan as well on government bonds, I think for at least over 5 years. So that, again, is completely misplaced for the current economic circumstances. Yeah. And when you get a big switch in terms of interest rates, bond yields, then you've got a growing crisis all of a sudden because of the level of debt, government debt, corporate debt, financial debt, and also consumer debt. It is all at record levels all at the same time. So the ability of interest rates to rise very much actually is very, very severely limited before mm-hmm. it runs into the next credit crisis.
Yeah. No, that's frightening. And, of course, as you point out in your article, you remind us, again, that banks are highly levered. And so when they start to have, interest rates don't seem to be rising very much, but in percentage terms, they've risen a great deal. And that has already probably has started to cause a lot of losses on the books of the banks. The banks then become vulnerable at some point in time. And then what happens? Then they have to go back to another QE before they ever normalize rates? Is that what we've got ahead of us in 2018?
Well, the sequence of events has to be crisis first. The Fed then comes galloping to the rescue and writes an open check, and there's QE and there's everything else. But you've got to have that crisis first. They're not going to do it before then. Until then, the Fed is still going to be pursuing the mantra of, we've got to normalize interest rates and so on and so forth. We've got to reduce our balance sheet, which I think is actually quite difficult for them to do, but it's not going to stop them trying to do it. Mm-hmm. Then you get the credit crisis, and then the whole thing stops and they go into reverse. I think that the economists in Fed think it's most unfair. They try very hard to get it right, and then suddenly the market upsets all their plans. But I think you and I would have a slightly different approach to this. But,
well, I think we would, yes. Well, Alistair, let me ask you about some of the practical market applications here now. You're talking about the much more severely depressed interest rates in Germany and Japan, places like that, that if they're going to normalize to the extent they try to and rates start to rise there, I suppose that should make for a stronger euro, a stronger yen perhaps, and the dollar then loses value relative to those currencies. Do you see it that way into 2018?
Yes, I do. And I see it a slightly different reason than you might sort of draw as an implication from what we've said so far. The problem I think that the dollar has is that it in 2018 it will begin to be replaced by the Chinese yuan.
Wow.
As a trade settlement currency, and I think that where this is going to really catch the headlines is when the Shanghai Futures Exchange starts offering a contract in oil exchange for yuan. Now, the reason this is important is that China is increasingly requiring her oil suppliers to sell oil for yuan. If if say Saudi Arabia wants to sell oil to China, Saudi Arabia is going to want to keep its market share. If it turns around and says, I'm sorry, we're only taking dollars because of some agreement that King Faisal came up with back in 1974 with mm-hmm. President Nixon, the Chinese are going to say, well, okay, that's your problem, but we're going to give preference to people who sell for our own currency.
Yeah, and I believe, Alistair, I saw somewhere January 18th is when they're going to start that.
Yes, this is not officially confirmed, but apparently, I think, as Bloomberg said, a trader with knowledge, as it were, said that that's when we can expect that contract to start. They've done all the testing and all the rest of it, and this contract, actually, they wanted to introduce for the last 3 or 4 years or so, when they first started talking about it. It's actually a very, very sensitive thing, because as you can imagine, that if we begin to see the petrodollar regime being chipped away, then inevitably that is going to rebound very, very much against the dollar, against the purchasing power of the dollar, which is why, you know, which is why it's such a sensitive subject. If we're seeing, in effect, the end of the petrodollar, and the petrodollar deal was between President Nixon and the King of Saudi Arabia back in 1974, if we see the end of that agreement, effectively we're calling time on the dollar being the unit of pricing for all traded commodities around the world.
That's huge. This is a potentially a huge development.
It is. I'm not saying that this will happen immediately. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that this is the first crack, if you like, in the eggshell of dollar hegemony. And in that sense, I think it's very important. When we see that contract, we will tell ourselves that is the end of the dollar period, which ran from 1974. Before then, obviously, we had the Nixon shock in 1971. So you had a sort of period, if you like, between 1971 and 1974, when the dollar replaced gold, if you like, as the reserve currency and became accepted as such, particularly in the energy markets, which were so sensitive at that time. Now we're looking post that era. So I think this is a very, very important development that we're likely to see in the coming months. Now, the Chinese could well try and delay it. They've delayed and delayed and delayed this contract. But I think it's getting to the point where they cannot really delay it anymore, simply because if they don't do this contract, someone else will do it. They could do it in Dubai tomorrow, because Dubai already has, for example, a gold contract settled in yuan, which is priced off the Shanghai Gold Exchange. Of course, all the oil producing nations in the Middle East surround Dubai. It's the natural center for them to issue such a contract for those countries selling oil to China, being settled in yuan. So, this to me has got a huge feeling of inevitability about it.
Wow.
And this is why I think that, you know, finally China has got to give in and accept it. And in any event, it's the direction of travel which China wants to go in anyway. She wants to replace the dollar with her own currency for the purposes of her own trade.
Alistair, there is another element to this, too, I believe, that you haven't spoken about yet, and that is the Chinese have built up their gold reserves dramatically, as have the Russians to a certain extent. And is it then possible that we might see, for example, Saudi Arabia, if there's, and they are, as I understand, China is Saudi Arabia's largest customer now, that Saudi Arabia might say, well, I'm not so sure about yuan, how about they could take their yuan and go buy gold with it then.
Yeah.
Is that part of the deal here?
I don't think that that is part of the deal as such, but the whole point about having a futures contract to hedge your currency risk is that you can then use that contract to hedge into something else. This is why gold is important. Now, whether Saudi Arabia would be so insensitive to do that, I actually doubt it. But one country which will definitely do it is Iran. Because, as far as Iran is concerned, the dollar is the currency of Satan.
Yeah.
This is an almost official statement. Not only that, but America is ramping up again the rhetoric against Iran.
Right.
And it seems to me that it's more than a coincidence that you've got President Trump tweeting about, all the sort of, no human rights and all the rest of it, and how terrible and undemocratic Iran is. Yet at the same time, you have got all these, the whole thing is being stoked up. So to my mind, I think Iran wants that contract because it doesn't want to use the dollar at all. And furthermore, it is completely aware that America will do everything to stop Iran using the dollar. So that, to me, I think is the initial situation. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting, it'll come out in time. I mean, we have seen the price of gold shoot up recently, and the open interest on COMEX, I don't think I've seen it increase so rapidly in such a short period of time ever since I really started observing it. Mm. I mean, we've gained 54,000 contracts since the market bottomed back in the 11th or 12th of December. The price has risen from around about 12:30. Yeah. We're currently at 13:20-ish or 13:15, without stopping. I mean, this is very, very sudden, steep interest in gold, and I wonder when the dust settles whether we'll sort of turn around and think, there are a whole sort of confluence of things coming together. I mean, another thing worth mentioning is that it's not just this oil contract, you know, suddenly sort of coming on January the 18th, if that's when they start dealing. Mm-hmm. But the governor of the Central Bank of China actually had a meeting on the 27th of December with the finance minister of Saudi Arabia. Mm. So what do they talk about? I don't think it was the grandchildren. I think it was about things like this contract, and the ability of Saudi Arabia to hedge. I have little doubt that the subject of an Aramco stake came up in this. Mm-hmm. We also know that China has various other joint investment projects, which it's doing with Saudi Arabia, in Saudi Arabia. So there is actually quite a sort of tight bond beginning to be formed between China and Saudi Arabia. So, yeah, I think this is interesting. And to see gold suddenly shoot up like this at the same time tells me that I think we're probably guessing in the right direction here.
Yeah, there certainly have been a lot of changes politically and a coup d'etat of sorts in Saudi Arabia, too. I wonder if there might be some connections with all of that. The old regime in Saudi Arabia being replaced by a newer, younger regime, and then, as I understand it, that China is Saudi Arabia's largest customer. The United States used to be, no longer true. I suppose our fracking and our own self-reliance to a certain extent maybe was sort of self-destructive in terms of the existing petrodollar scheme, which is, to me, Alistair, it seems like it could be empire-ending kind of a thing if it goes too far.
Yeah, well, Saudi Arabia actually sells very little or no oil to America now at all.
Yeah.
Most of your light stuff comes from Nigeria, that side of the pond, as it were, which is a lot closer. The point you're making is right, and that is that Saudi Arabia's commercial interests are very much into Asia, and particularly China, which of course is the engine of the future prospects for the whole of the Asian continent.
Sure.
I mean, with all the infrastructure development and transportation and all the rest of it, people don't realize just how rapidly this development is occurring.
Yeah.
In China, they're now shipping these standard container units from China into Europe and back again at an incredible rate. I mean, something like 400,000 units. Hmm. The reason this is important is that at the moment it takes less than 2 weeks to get from Beijing to Stuttgart, let's say, or alternatively for a manufactured Mercedes car to get from Stuttgart to Beijing.
Sure.
Now that compares with 30 days by sea. So you can see that the time value of all this infrastructure is so beneficial to China, to Europe, to trade. And America is not taking part in this at all. America is almost isolating herself from this. America is turning around and saying, you want to trade with us, you're going to have to pay tariffs. We're not prepared to offer you any favorable deals.
Yeah.
So, America is just cutting herself out of this deal.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is one reason. Getting back to a basic question you had, and that is the relationship between the various currencies. I would say that this is one very, very good reason why the US currency will be weak over the course of 2018.
All right, let's just summarize here then. If we're looking at, I think what I hear you saying is you can't really afford to pay too much attention to economist predictions as we hear them on the mainstream media. A more reliable method is to look at capital flows, and the capital flows then would seem to suggest bullishness for commodities and precious metals, bearishness for financial assets, for stocks, for bonds, and then perhaps for stocks as well. Is that sort of what you see going into 2018 as we
absolutely
progress here?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the relationship in financial markets is bonds tend to peak first. Well, we've seen that. They peaked back in 2012, 2013, the turn of the year. Equities then peak second, and I would think that fairly shortly we will see that. And as bond yields have their next sort of jump up, that will really start undermining the equity markets. And when you start getting price inflation coming in, at that stage, I think that that will begin, you know, the equity markets will begin to get really frightened about higher interest rates. And at that stage, I think it will take a pretty nasty toss.
All right. Well, it's great food for thought as we start this new year. Alistair, thank you as always for spending time with us. It's always a pleasure. Your insights are so valuable. And I would tell our listeners to go to goldmoney.com to read Alistair's. And there's a couple of other analysts there that also provide some great ideas. Go there, goldmoney.com, and also avail yourself to the services that this wonderful company now provides. I certainly have, and really, really highly recommend Gold Money to my listeners. Thank you, Alistair, for being with us, and I hope we can do it again sometime very soon.
I hope so, too, and it was very much my pleasure, and happy new year to all your listeners.
Thank you very much, Alistair, and same to you and yours. Well, next week we'll have another fascinating guest. I'm not sure exactly who it's going to be just yet. Go to jtaylormedia.com to keep up with this radio show, as well as very important articles that appear there, too. So until next week, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Uranium Energy Corp.
NYSE Market, UEC.
Is a leader in the coming bull market in uranium. With spot uranium up more than 40% in 2 months, the new bull market is just starting. UEC has the cash, the licensed resources, the permitted processing center, the advanced technology, and the experienced team to lead this market. Get to know this exciting company now by visiting UraniumEnergy.com.
NYSE Market, UEC.